a really quick and exciting announcement to make. The Menopause and Cancer Podcast is now also on YouTube, and I'm so excited that more people now get to watch our conversations. So the link to the YouTube channel is in our show notes. Please go and subscribe to the channel so that more people who need to hear our conversations are able to find them. Thank you. Welcome to the Menopause and Cancer Podcast, where we speak with cancer patients, survivors, and incredible menopause experts and specialists in their fields to help us find solutions to our symptoms and ideas to improve our health. My name is Dani Binnington, and I am beyond excited to welcome Dr. Elizabeth Coman onto the show today to talk about the fascinating history of women's health as it's never been told before. Elizabeth is a breast oncologist at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in America, and she's also just written a book called All in Her Head. And I am beyond intrigued, and I have been intrigued about this book because Elizabeth goes back in history to talk about women's health. She also has a whole chapter on hormones in her book. And really, it's a crucial learning for all of us to understand why we're so much on the back foot and how can medicine justify treating us and putting us women into menopause far too early and then not giving us the support we need. I'm going to read you a short paragraph before I invite Elizabeth onto the show. For as long as medicine has been a practice, women's bodies have been treated like objects to be practiced on, examined and ignored, idealized and sexualized, shamed, subjugated, mutilated, and dismissed. The story of women's healthcare is a story in which women themselves have often been voiceless, a narrative instead written from the perspective of men who styled themselves as authorities on the female of the species, yet uninformed by women's own voices, thoughts, fears, pain, and experiences. The result is a cultural and societal legacy that continues to shape the mistreatment and care of women. I can't wait to speak to Elizabeth. I really hope you enjoy this conversation. I couldn't think of a better guest that has written a more extraordinary book than Elizabeth to really kick off Women's History Month with all of you together. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us on the Menopause and Cancer Podcast. How are you today?
I'm good. I'm so grateful to be here with you today.
Officially, your book has not been released, but you have kindly sent me papers. I've printed your whole book off. My printer just didn't stop printing. It's a big book. And this is an incredible piece of work you've put together with over 800 quotations. You've put decades of knowledge and your work and expertise into this book. I could not stop highlighting. Everything is highlighted. I've got highlighted pages. Now everything is highlighted and I don't know where to start. Let's start with you. You're a breast oncologist. You work for one of the leading cancer centers in America. Tell me about you. Tell us, who are you?
So my name's Dr. Elizabeth Coman. I've had one career my whole life, and that is taking care of breast cancer patients. So when I was in college, I volunteered at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, working with breast cancer patients, helping them with wigs and breast prostheses. And at the same time, I had an aunt who was diagnosed with breast cancer. And this was right at the time when Herceptin was coming about, and it was in a lottery to even get it. And I was majoring in the history of medicine and really interested in the ethics behind how we care for patients, how new drugs are developed. So at the same time, I was working with breast cancer patients. I had an aunt who was diagnosed with breast cancer. And then I started working in a lab there as well. So I had this kind of emotional, intellectual, soulful triumvirate of understanding, learning about the biology of cancer, seeing it firsthand from an emotional, personal perspective. And then in addition to that, working with women really at a young age and seeing how it is not just about the biology of the disease, but really the experience of illness, which is, I think, so much about what we're going to talk about today. And when it came to writing this book, for me, it was this deep dive into the recognition, I think, that we all have that medicine doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's inextricably linked to culture, religion, politics, history, and how that is so deeply intertwined with our experience in the world. And then when you become sick, how that is deeply influenced by all these other forces. And for me, when we look at the history of medicine, women's voices were lost. They surely had them, but we were not listening. And we are trying to today. And that is really the mission behind this book, is to galvanize a larger movement to acknowledge the insidious legacy that we've all inherited when we show up at the doctor's office today. And some of the quotes in the book are really so egregious. It's like, oh my God, did people really say this? Yes. But I almost think what's harder is what's not said today. And that we may not be hearing these horrific things like girls can't go to medical school or your uterus is wandering, but still women are uncared for. And why is that? And how can we do better? And that's really the platform and mission behind it all.
Yeah. And All in Her Head really talks about the history of what happened to us as women. And you go way back, which I think is really exciting, because in my work, every single week, I speak to patients who've had a cancer diagnosis and then are pushed into menopause. And I always felt there is this big vacuum. Everyone helps us survive cancer. And then very few people, institutions, organizations help us live well beyond cancer. And the menopause is obviously a big thing. You call it the devil's bargain. And I want to get to that at the end of our conversation, because we know these are lifelong and life prolonging treatments that are really important for all of us cancer survivors. But let's go way back. Hormones. Tell us, I know you said in your book, it was only in the 1900s that the word hormone was actually put into the dictionary or into our sort of inner word. But we know about hormones and how much havoc they cause from much earlier on. I wanted to hop on here quickly to thank our partner Empowder for getting this episode out to you. Now, I know that so many of you think that you want to try herbal supplements or whole food supplements and you have no idea where to start. There is worry about contraindications, and rightly so. And also there is a little bit of confusion as to what supplement might work for what symptom. And so when I reached out to the fantastic team at Empowder and I said, look, I know many women in our community take your supplements and say they are really beneficial for them, but I also know many others out there have no idea where to even start. They're worried about contraindications. Can you help me maybe do some research? The team at Empowder were amazing. They have done so much research. They've compiled a whole document for us explaining the evidence and the data we have so far. And they also talked to me about all of the things we don't know. You don't find many brands out there who say, hands on heart, a few of the ingredients in our supplements aren't going to be right for everyone in your community, Danny. And we're really happy to talk about that. So I can't thank the team at Empowder enough for being so transparent, for being so helpful, and for being so supportive. And so do go and check them out. Check out the episode we recorded with them a few weeks ago, but check out their products. They are on empowder.store on any web browser. Go and find them. I love the Gut Instinct product. I know many of you like the Mood Food product. Look at the ingredients. Check out the podcast we've done for further research for yourself. And for me, I just really want to thank Empowder for supporting our community and for really doing so much legwork for us.
Yeah. And I think just to pick up on something you said about how we don't fully address, or at all in many instances, how women thrive, that it's not just about surviving, but what does it mean to really live? And I think before we can even address that in a cancer patient and in a diagnosis and with treatment, we need to know what that looks like way before a cancer diagnosis. And the problem with medicine is that in all the aspects of a woman's body, and All in Her Head is a walk through women's body by organ system, the way we learn about it at med school, is we have neglected so many areas of caring for women in lots of ways, that when they actually are diagnosed with cancer and then have these other organ-specific problems or new disease presentations, we struggle with how to manage that because we weren't doing it before the cancer diagnosis as it is.
Right. So we're on the back foot.
We are really, really trying to play catch up because we weren't doing it good before, and now it's even harder to do after. With respect to the history of, I was just blown away myself reading and researching the history of the discovery of hormones. Because if you go back in time, you know, women were perceived as, at various stages of history, the imperfect, inverted version of a man. We are not that. And even today, we are not the reference 70 kilogram white male that goes historically into a clinical trial. And we are certainly not small men where you can just assume that the pharmacodynamics or the metabolism that happens in a man is going to translate equally to a woman. But when you start off with this vision that we are not as good, we are not as smart, we are not as strong, we are not as capable, and you start off with that mindset, then how the science gets discovered fits into the mindset and those who are really exploring it, which was predominantly men. So with respect to the history of discovering hormones, it's really not very different. We thought years ago, you know, thousands of years ago, okay, well, it was the wandering womb. And then we know that the womb doesn't wander. It's actually tethered in place. Well, maybe it's our ovaries that are making us absolutely crazy and we should remove those. And, you know, maybe the clitoris too, if we're really out of whack and not behaving. But the discovery of hormones that really is fascinating is that the mindset led to this binary focus, that there was going to be, you know, estrogen in women or some sort of chemical in women as a messenger that, well, we're not, it's not just our ovaries, but we're bathed in this nonsense. And then a discovery of testosterone, which is why we're so virile, why men are virile, what makes them strong, what makes them great. And this binary assumption limits how we help women today. I mean, if you look at some of the things that endocrinologists and urogynecologists talk about, particularly now, it's that we don't really have an understanding of how we can and should potentially supplement women with testosterone as part of hormone replacement therapy. And if you assume that that's only, if the mindset is that this is something that is predominantly for men, then we miss the fact that women and men both have testosterone. They both have estrogen, just in varying degrees.
Yeah. And I love this about your book. And I want to read that one quote, if you allow me to. Every human body, regardless of sex, is internally awash in hormones. Every human being, regardless of sex, produces the sex hormones associated with both female and male bodies. Somehow only women have ever been saddled with the suggestion that their hormones make them unpredictable, incompetent, and unfit for certain types of work. And only women are commonly dismissed as hormonal when their emotions or behavior become inconvenient. And I want to touch on a story that really touched me when you were a student in medical school.
Yeah.
And you witnessed a really difficult accident. And it was, I think, your first shift in A&E. Is that true? Can you talk us through that moment?
Oh, I can almost cry now. I mean, the thing about medical, and if I do, it's okay.
It's okay.
I think the thing about medical training is those first experiences become just indelible and imprinted in your mind, and you never forget them. The things that become routine in your life as a physician are not routine when you first see them happen. So when I was in medical school, I knew I wasn't going to be a surgeon, but I had this attitude, well, I have to do everything super, super hard and to the max. And I kind of regret that. But one of the things that I did was I did my surgical rotation at Mass General Hospital, which has changed, but at that time was extremely cutthroat. There was a lot of hazing of medical students and residents. There were no work hours. You would work 24 hours on call and then the following day have lectures as a medical student and be expected to be awake and then do it again all over again. So every other day you were at least there 24 hours. Some days you might be there 36 hours at a time. With very limited time to sleep or eat or anything like that, let alone, I mean, self-care, there was no self-care. But there was one night where there was a young girl who was in a horrific accident. And I mean, I don't go fully into it in the book, but I was so worried. I saw her mother and I was so worried about the patient. I was worried about the mother. And I actually went to get the mother a sandwich and one of the residents said, that's not your job. What are you doing? And he also saw me crying and basically implied that there was no way I was going to ever have a future as a surgeon or as a doctor if I couldn't keep myself together in talking with this mother. And it was so awful. And I said, the experience was so awful of him telling me that. And then I didn't know what to say in the moment. So I said, well, you know, it's just the estrogen got the better of me.
So what you are talking about in your book is something that we often experience ourselves, isn't it? We're so conditioned. We are so programmed. It's almost in our DNA that we blame things on our hormones.
Yeah. Exactly. And it wasn't the first, that was just one example. I had so many. I mean, even in recent years, I'm very emotional. I cry with patients. It's just built into the fabric of who I am. And I, over the years, have apologized so much for that emotionality and blame and said, and kind of just said jokingly, oh, well, you know, it's all my extra estrogen. Why am I saying that? What is wrong with me?
Yeah, but I love the fact that you talk about these stories and you say how we are wired and conditioned. And at the same time, you're giving us the research and the facts of where it actually all comes from. This isn't just our generation. We're going back to the 1300s. I read your book, you quote so many amazing doctors who have all played a part in shaping, finding out about women's hormones, how they work. And in fact, it was initially a man that thought, ooh, maybe he can make himself a little
more
bit
virile.
a bit more virile, right? So it really all started with an exploration for men as well of if they injected themselves a bit more of that oomph. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, so Dr. Brown Sicard, I think I just pronounced his name wrong, but it's okay. He's not coming after me anytime soon. he was 72. He wanted to make himself more virile and he explored with injecting himself with crushed guinea pig testicles and proceeded to publish after that, you know, this was making him more virile. His urine stream was more direct and forceful. He had more strength. Ultimately, his papers were debunked and he was more shunned by the medical community. But this sort of, in some measure, launched the idea of a hormone replacement therapy. He did also mention that maybe ovaries could do this as well, and might there be a therapy in that? But if you look at the history of hormone replacement for women, I mean, it's a sordid tale. I was trying not to drop too many explicitives. I was wondering where is this podcast going? I have to be careful with my unfiltered mouth.
You don't have to be careful, and you don't have to be unfiltered. We want to hear it how you think it.
Yeah, I mean, it's disastrous. If you look at the original, I mean, we have just ping-ponged women back and forth through the history of medicine. Even when we did discover that hormone replacement therapy might be helpful, initially we were giving it to everybody, and then with the Women's Health Initiative telling everybody that they're going to get breast cancer, and then swinging in the other direction, where now we are recognizing that we need to speak with women on an individual basis about what their needs are. But there's also a question of, and this is quite provocative, for breast cancer patients, will there ever be a way to supplement hormones?
Yeah. And I had a conference last summer. It was the launch of our Menopause and Cancer Not-for-Profit, which I have set up because I feel there is such an injustice. And one of the doctors who is a menopause specialist, a British Menopause Society accredited specialist, said he hopes that in his lifetime, there will be more studies that can add to that dilemma. Because so many patients ask him about it, and he is so upset about the lack of evidence that he can guide women on. And it's a big question mark, isn't it?
There is controversy, but it's a question mark. Well, if you look, you can see one of the quotes from one of the gynecology oncologists that I work with, Kara Long Roche, who writes about there's no world where we would castrate men and then not properly address what are the real questions about giving them back testosterone. So one interesting question is for triple negative breast cancer patients. So those are patients who do not have a cancer that needs estrogen to grow, right? But they're estrogen receptor negative, they're progesterone receptor negative. These are patients who may have gone through menopause because, you know, an accelerated menopause because of chemotherapy or other causes. And they have asked, well, why? Or they have to have their ovaries removed because of BRCA or other inherited risk mutation. why are we unable to give those women physiologic hormone back, right? Why are there not enough studies done on those women? It's really, really complicated. And we've abandoned women in medicine is the bottom line. And we need to do better. Because I just want to be really clear. If you have your ovaries and you have triple negative breast cancer and they're functioning, they're making a certain level of hormone, right? Yeah. And if you remove the ovaries and are talking about giving back something less than what they would have had physiologic, they don't have ovarian cancer, but removing their ovaries because they have a risk of it, why can't we do that? Why don't we have more studies to show that you could give even a lower level of physiologic hormone and have that be safe? Why don't we know that answer yet?
Yeah. I think when I read your book, there were quite a few moments where I feel, where I felt outraged at that injustice. And looking back over all of the examples that you've given of how we sort of always compare to men and always were on the back foot, I wonder how it feels for you, understanding so crucially how we've always been on the back foot, how women have not been studied, how we've been really deserved with so many things. And now you're in a situation as a breast cancer oncologist who is routinely putting women into the menopause because it saves their lives. It's a tricky situation, isn't it?
It's a heartbreaking situation. It's heartbreaking because there are so many ways that women need and should feel good in their bodies, whether it's being able to exercise, whether it's being able to think clearly, whether it's being able to enjoy their bodies sexually, whatever it may be. And all of that is impacted by chemical menopause that we can thrust women into. And it's very interesting when you look at the antidepressant market in the United States and who predominantly gets put on antidepressants. Women are far more put on antidepressants around menopause. I'm not talking about breast cancer patients, but just in general. We market antidepressants to women dramatically. And I'm not saying that there isn't a huge need for that, but in the same way that I think that some of those menopausal women may need other treatments. They may need vaginal estrogen. They may need other things to help them through the symptoms of menopause that they're having, as opposed to just saying, you're upset, let's give you an antidepressant. I think in the same way that we've kind of blanket tried to treat breast cancer patients who have chemically induced menopause, or we put them into menopause with just one shop fits all or one stop for everything, it's simply not the case. And we don't have enough modalities to help women along the way. One thing that I think has been very helpful is recent studies showing that you can give intravaginal estrogen safely. And this has been really a game changer for a lot of women. Yeah. But it's taken us so long to get there. Why is it that we are historically two times more likely to ask men about sexual side effects from cancer-directed therapy than we are women? That is simply unacceptable. Are we just assuming that women don't want to enjoy and have sex? Why are we doing that? Or that they don't want their vaginas to hurt? I mean, that should be baseline.
Yeah. Yeah. It's maybe going back to what you said, or the conversations we often have. It's the visual, isn't it? A man's penis, and everyone knows what a penis and testicles look like. And, you know, it's taken me to get into my 30s to really know the difference between my vulva and my vagina. And I can say that now because it was through this work and through talking to so many women. And we made a joke when my children were little, and it was like, there is an in vagina. The vagina is on the inside. And we talk about it very readily now, but there are still people.
I love that.
And it was
why
just
is it that we can't say vulva? Do we never say it? Why is that?
Someone
needs to do a podcast on that. Maybe we just need to say vulva 1,000 times and get it out there.
Go. You've said it once.
Vulva. I'll do it. What else do we need to say? Clitoris? I mean, we just talk openly about women's anatomy. Not only do we not talk about it, but historically we forget about it. I mean, I love the term clitorisy because that is just missed in medical training. I mean, this is also something in the book, the number of times that the clitoris is either discovered or rediscovered or lost by a man in a textbook is extraordinary. And during the Renaissance, you know, there were several physicians that claimed to have discovered this anatomical pearl. Did you ask a woman? Did you ask a woman anytime? You didn't discover it. We knew where it was. And if you look at anatomical textbooks, Gray's Anatomy, it's at one point didn't even have it in there. And historically, including during my training, what you learn is that it's this tiny little nub, when in fact, it took a female urologist in 2005 to actually map the entirety of the clitoris. 2005. We have a lot of catch up to do. Yes.
Yeah. So in your medical training, what do you wish you had learned more for when you wanted to become a breast oncologist? What about, like, because this is where it goes back to, isn't it? Every week I sit here and I record a podcast, and we have done so for over 2 years because there are so many topics to talk about, right? Whether women can or want to go on hormone replacement therapy or not, we need to manage these postmenopausal bodies the best we can. We need to talk about exercise and all of those things. It's important to address it all. So I would be talking about this for years to come, I'm sure. But we need to go back also and start to educate where the change happens. patients, isn't it? And often when you get to the oncologist, yes, oncologists need to help us talk about it more, and our surgeons and our clinical nurse specialists, but rewinding and going back, like, what had you wished you'd learned as a young medical student that would really have helped you in your work today?
I think number one, two, and three, that our bodies matter. That our bodies matter. And that there was absolutely no addressing any concept. I mean, we never talked about menopause, period. I had zero training in that, zero. But in order to understand the changes and the longings and the problems that women have during menopause, we need to honor what works before or what needs to be addressed before. And if we're shaming women and their sexuality, we're not talking about women's libido, we're not talking about sexual desire, we're not talking about anatomy properly in medical school, then women have, when women lose it or have complaints or have problems, we don't even know how to address it because we don't know what a good day looks like for them because we never even asked. And we don't celebrate that and we don't talk to women. You know, I never saw never heard in any of my training anything about, as I said, menopause, how we help women, what that might look like. Sexual side effects from medication were certainly never discussed. We heard all about erectile dysfunction, but never about libido and sexual issues that women might have.
Wow.
I mean, there's too much of have a glass of wine and relax. That's not helping women.
Yeah. That's just incredible, isn't it?
Or that it's all in your head.
Sometimes all in her head.
All in your head. So you know what? Sometimes if you're having painful intercourse or painful intimate relations, you're not going to want to repeat doing that. Why are we addressing that at all?
Yeah. Do you feel your patients can honestly talk to you about the havoc of being in menopause, whether it's medical or surgical, means is to you? Because when we talk to many patients, it's hard to talk to our oncologists about that. Out of the whole team, we know our oncologists, your first interest is to help us survive our cancer diagnoses. So you offer us treatments, and we know you would only give us a treatment that you know is going to help us increase our survival rates. Whether that's 1% or 10% or 50%, you are doing an amazing job. And so it's sometimes really hard to say how difficult it is to be on those treatments. And we know women stop their tamoxifen, for example, and never tell their doctors. It's upsetting and heartbreaking. Yeah. And for you too, because you care about your patients.
I'm taking a deep breath because there's so much to unpack there. I think it's a challenging question to answer because I think it's heartbreaking that we don't create enough space for women to share what they need to share in order to get the kind of help that they need to get. And that requires time. So one of the biggest issues, I think, is we have a healthcare system that rushes our patients. You know, we assume that a follow-up healthy visit, someone who's not in active therapy, may only take 20 minutes. Well, you may not be acutely ill. You may not be getting chemotherapy. But if you've got a real issue related to whatever side effect or any symptom that you have, that can take longer than 20 minutes. It may take you 15 minutes just to feel comfortable. And we don't build in that time in our healthcare system. People need time and space to breathe. I remember I had this recent surgery and I was so worried about it. I almost couldn't speak. I was so anxious, right? And I knew that the doctor needed to get out of the room and he was a surgeon. So if we don't give patients that space, I think that's a huge problem. And I can't fix our imperfect healthcare system in that way. The other issue is that, and this is quite provocative, when I think about who goes into oncology, there's lots of different minds that go into oncology. They're all, to everybody that I've experienced in the field, incredibly mission-driven. It is a calling. Some of that calling is always driven to help the patient, but some part of it, maybe because their mind works in biological ways and they think about small molecules and math and science, and it's hard to break free from that. Other people enter it because they're drawn to the biology, but even more so the narrative aspect of medicine, the intensity of the emotion that goes into it. They are more emotionally connected in that way and may have a higher EQ. Not every oncologist that patients see is going to have that high EQ in the way that they would want so that they can have the kind of conversations that need to happen when we talk about some of the symptoms that women have from menopause. And that requires really being there and holding space for the shame that women may feel, the embarrassment that they may feel, the anatomical questions that they have, the real emotional trauma that they want to talk about. And not every doctor, as wonderful as they may be, may either have the time for that because of the system or the emotional fabric to be present for that. Not every doctor is all things all the time. And so I think what ends up happening is you need to have partners in that experience. Maybe it's the nurse, maybe it's a nurse practitioner. Maybe you don't feel comfortable talking to your doctor, but you say, is there a sexual health clinic? For example, at Memorial Sloan Kettering, we do have a sexual health clinic that is for women. And so we can say, look, we may not be able to have this conversation now, but I need this help. Can you refer me to someone? And that may unburden the oncologist for a conversation that we can talk till the cows come home. We wish they might be able to do better, but they might not be able to. And we have to have frank conversations. If your doctor is not equipped, you're not going to feel comfortable. And if you need to still stay with that doctor, then there may be other ways to partner with other care providers who can really address some of the things that you may not feel comfortable talking about. Like, and if your doctor's not saying vulva comfortably, you may not want to be talking about, you know, your intimate life.
This is the test, isn't it? Just a quick message for everyone. Today is the 6th of March, and I am realizing that there are so many things going on in our menopause and cancer world, and I never really have the time to share it all with you because I'm so aware that you're all really busy. And I know when you tune into our podcast conversations, you have really sort of, you know, all of these great topics to get into. But I must tell you, we are going on a roadshow this year. And if you follow us on social media or if you subscribe to our newsletter, then you probably know already. And next weekend, that's the 15th and 16th of March, we're going to be in Leeds. We have teamed up with the amazing Maggie's Center, and we're going to hold a whole day of all things menopause and cancer at Maggie's in Leeds. And so if any of you Yorkshire people want to join us, have a look. I think all of the tickets have gone, but we're all meeting on the 15th in the evening down at the docks in Leeds as well for a really amazing evening of mixing and mingling. I'll be giving a talk. There'll be food, there'll be drinks. And I'm going to link the Eventbrite page into the show notes here. So if you're in Yorkshire and if you have been listening to these conversations for a long time now, and if you want to come and connect, because this podcast isn't just about listening and you absorbing, this is really about creating community. And the communities we have created off the back of this podcast have been amazing. So let's do much more of that this year. And if you are in Yorkshire, then come and join us next weekend. We kind of need to have more of those conversations amongst survivors, because I think the more we practice having these conversations and sharing and showing up and releasing some of that guilt, the guilt is immense for women to still be here 5 years after an initial diagnosis, still feeling really bad, thinking they should feel better. And then you feel like you're sort of like half living, but you should be ever so grateful to be alive. It's not a great conversation to have with your doctor when you feel they've done so much for you to survive. And then you're sort of grappling with all of these side effects. So the more we speak, the more we practice, the better I think our conversations are going to be with our doctors. Because I do think it's a two-pronged approach. I always teach, when I teach our workshops, I always say it's a two-pronged approach. We also are there to structure our doctor appointments. The doctor is also there to guide us, but it is a two-way thing. It's a communication and it's a partnership.
Mm-hmm. I think, I'm so sad when I hear that there may be guilt associated with surviving, and that surviving is never enough. We are not on this earth to just survive. There's just such beauty to be felt, experiences to be had, joy to be experienced. And that is why we fight so hard to live. And so if we're only in this to survive, then we're not fully engaging with our patients as physicians. We're not fully actualizing our mission to care for people.
And I would love for everyone at home listening to you say this, whether they're feeling they're doing more than surviving, you know, out of all these thousands and thousands of people. And I don't know, I always imagine, what do they do at home? Are they doing their washing up? Do they walk their dog? What do you do right now, listening to Elizabeth and myself at home? And how do you feel right now? Are you living? Are you thriving? Are you just getting through the day, surviving? Some people are early on after active treatment. And it's a good question to ask.
Yeah, I think some days it is one foot in front of the other. Some days it is, can I be 1% better every day? And maybe I'm 2% worse one day, but can I, is my overall momentum forward? But we need to have more good days than bad days. We need to have those people who can partner with us on those really bad days to say, how do we get to more good days? What does a good day really look like for us? And how do we envelop that into the kind of care that we provide patients?
Yeah. You spoke about an example in your book of a lady who was after a hormone positive breast cancer, and she came to you, she saw you, and she wanted help. And then she walked out of the appointment. And I kind of thought you were going to go with the story. She became your patient and you helped her manage and you helped her with some other non-hormonal prescribable options.
Yeah.
But you never saw that patient again.
No. She's a composite patient, right? I mean, when you write a book like this, I can't tell, you know, for all sorts of ethical reasons, you can't perfectly match a patient to a story. But the reality is she's a composite of so many women I have seen that we lose to the system, or we lose to the world, to the ether of not fully being able to care for patients in the way that we want to. Maybe that's because we don't have the time and we need more time. And also it's because I think our treatments are not as good as what they should be. And people are despondent. They want better. They want more. And we don't always know why they're not taking their medication or where we missed the boat. We do our best, but our best is not always good enough.
Mm-hmm. That is, it really sort of touched me, that example, because I know from you and from speaking to you that you so care. Like you said earlier, you're close to tears a lot of times and you're an emotional human being. And it's wonderful to hear that side from you. And so every single patient is going to leave an imprint on you and your story, because you have your own story and you are a patient as well, right? And we're never doctors. We all are everything and we're so much more than a survivor or a doctor. And that is why I think a true partnership really leaves such a big imprint. Like I can still visualize the hair on my oncologist's face when he spoke to me. It is really imprinted in my memory. And I'm sure
his facial
patients,
hair?
Yeah, sadly.
His facial hair?
Yeah, in very odd places. And yes, his facial hair.
Oh, okay. Got it. I mean, thank God I do electrolysis. Thank God.
And so, and so I think there is so much emotion attached to all of this, isn't it? And all of our conversations and our partnerships, that we can't remove that.
It's oncology is a deeply, I think about this every day and why and how I ended up in the field that I did. It's a deeply, deeply emotional field for everybody involved. It's not removing a mole. It's not a surgery where you're one and done and you maybe never see the patient again. It's a field that you enter because you anticipate and expect continuity of care no matter the outcome, which is a very unusual thing to say in medicine. I will partner with you no matter what. I will be present for your suffering no matter what. I'm going to do everything in my power to give you the best possible treatment, but medical science is where it is in 2024. It's not perfect. It's not a disease. Even when we cure, that will not cause damage in some way, even if it's not physical, then psychological damage. And when you become an oncologist and you see patients, even the ones that we think that we talk about, you know, maybe not be as emotionally present, it's impossible as a human not to absorb the experience of caring for patients. And for me, that becomes a lot of the anxiety that I absorb from them. You know, I try to take their worries from them. I say sometimes with my kids, like, give me your worries, I'll put them on the worry tree. But for my patients, it's give me your worries, I'll hold them for you. But holding them for them becomes also heavy for me. And it's been a journey to figure out how to balance that and how to provide the best care, but also manage the tsunami that goes along with that.
Of course. Thank you for sharing that. In your career as a breast oncologist, what do you hope that might change? What advantages are you hoping that might even be realistic or unrealistic that might change for cancer survivors, especially in particular how we manage menopause?
Well, first, I want to do just a little bit of biology, which is that I think one of the biggest things that goes into the experience of living and surviving after diagnosis and being cured is the fear, is it going to come back? I think that becomes an overwhelming feeling for so many patients. There's a lot of research and science looking into how we can predict for that, treat it much earlier on, and again, move everyone more towards a cure so that we don't have this fear, this is going to come back 5 years later, this is going to come back 10 years later. Because that anxiety lives lives in the psyche and rents space way more headspace than we ever would want it to, and really impacts the ability of women to thrive and not just survive after their diagnosis. Yeah. With respect to menopausal symptoms, I think thanks to you and so many amazing women who are saying enough is enough, both from the patient advocacy standpoint, but you have many more, I will say there are male physicians, but especially female physicians who are saying this is unacceptable. This is unacceptable and we will do better. And there's so much crosstalk among institutions and different practicing doctors to improve upon this. I think particularly when it comes to menopausal symptoms associated with painful intercourse, painful sex, painful intimacy, we're getting much better at talking about women's anatomy, encouraging women to talk about their experiences, giving women education. These are things that we can do. And for example, the recent work that's shown that we can give intravaginal estrogen. This is huge because for so long we were saying you can't even look at estrogen, right? And I think that now there's a lot more discussion about how might we be able to supplement in different ways. What are the symptoms? Not just, oh, you're sad, let's give you an antidepressant. Oh, you're having a hot flash, let's just treat that. But what's really going on all these different levels that's impacting your ability to do well? I think that we're having those discussions, and from those discussions, the narrative will change.
I wish that this pill or whatever it's going to be to help people worry less about a recurrence is going to come to the market soon. And I will invest everything I have into it. That would be amazing, because personally, I'm here 10 years on from my primary triple negative breast cancer diagnosis. And I look back with a lot of sadness sometimes, because for so much of my time was I so utterly scared it would come back and get me. And what a bloody waste, Elizabeth, because I'm here and I'm here to share my story and I'm here to live life to the fullest. And I look back and I'm cross and annoyed and frustrated and also, of course, compassionate, because it's so normal, but I have all of these emotions. But because you're here, you think, oh my gosh, what a waste. We had all these lovely family holidays. We went on all these amazing trips. I met with thousands of women through my community of women. Like, life was amazing. And yet this underlying worry was always there. And I'm sure everyone listening, or when you mentioned that, would have nodded at home. And it's so great that you recognize that as an oncologist. Well, I'm so grateful. Yes,
it's the human experience, though. I mean, worry is part of who we are and what gives us what we hope is some sense of control, but it is so completely understandable. So please give yourself grace. I mean, even if it's not a cancer diagnosis, as a worrier myself, I wish I could take it back all the anxious moments.
Elizabeth, it's been great to speak to you. I have so many more things highlighted, but I kind of feel like my heart is full and I got enough out of our conversation to really, really sort of feel a little bit happier of where we are. I always feel extremely grateful speaking to an oncologist who gets us, because I feel many people think their oncologist might not really get them. And so to really sort of share that with everyone listening to us, and also for you to understand the injustice we had for women is just, amazing. I can't wait to buy the hard copy of your book to not have all of those thousands of printed off papers on my bedside table. Amazing what you have achieved with your work in putting this together. My hat's off to you. If I could write a chapter, I'd be so proud. You must be so proud of yourself.
You should be proud of yourself. Look at what you're doing. You're bringing voice to and amplifying a mission and a message that so many women need to hear. So my answer to you would be, we should be proud of ourselves together, and we're in it together. And let's hope we can do better by the world for women.
We will. Thank you for having me today and for giving us your time.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Really an honor.
What an amazing woman Elizabeth is. What a fabulous oncologist. And I can't tell you by holding all of the papers in my hand that I'd printed off when I was lucky enough to get my hands on the draft of her book. She is incredibly, incredibly clever. And it is for all of us now to stand up together to change women's history. For every woman, every man, every person listening to this podcast, whether you're a patient or a doctor, or if you have any other role in maybe supporting a loved one through their experiences, it is for all of us to shape history so that we can change this one narrative. And let me read another paragraph out of Elizabeth's book. Medicine's early and ultimately misinformed theories of how hormones worked in women's bodies may have been the more damaging when it came to women's equality, both in the eyes of the medical system and in society more broadly. An organ at least could be removed. The discovery of hormones, on the other hand, suggested that women were simply marinating at all times in a potent mix of chemicals that made them volatile, foolish, and emotionally unstable from the moment puberty hit. We're the generation, like Diane Dantenbrink, a very, very amazing menopause campaigner, always says, we're the generation that can make that change happen. And we're all doing this together. And when I really, truly think back to the conversation with Elizabeth, it's very much about having an open conversation and a partnership with all the people around us to speak up so that we don't remain voiceless, so that we trust our voice, our experiences, and we become brave enough to share them as they are. And with that, I really hope you enjoyed this episode. I am so grateful that Elizabeth gave us her time, and I hope you will go and buy her book, All in Her Head. I will link to Amazon now. It is fascinating reading. Lots of love, and I see and speak to you all next week.